Today is December 11th, 2013. This is the third and final interview with Kathy Middlecamp. I am Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Kathy, as I've asked you for the previous two interviews, would you say your name and spell your last name?
My name is Kathy Middlecamp. Middle, M-I-D-D-L-E, Camp, C-A-M-P.
So I think we're going to finish up here talking about the recent past, so the last decade or so.
Means we're getting old.
Yeah.
10 years is the recent past.
The thing that's most interesting to me is your shift from chemistry to integrated liberal studies and to the Nelson Institute. There's some other things I want to ask, but I want to make sure we have space for that. So we'll start with the even more recent past and ask how that all happened, how you shifted from chemistry to, I guess, first integrated liberal studies. If you want to start there, we'll go.
There's some parts I know, and there's some parts I don't know.
Okay. Why don't we talk about
this? I know how I got to ILS, the shorthand for Integrated Liberal Studies, a name that puzzles everybody as to what it is, but it's a certificate program in the College of Letters and Science. So I know how I got there. It was the chair of the program back somewhere shortly after 2000 invited me to lunch and said, we're looking for some science teachers who are good at what they do, tend to teach out of traditional curriculum boxes, and might have time to come teach a course in the ILS program. And I said, sure, tell me more. And the long story short, as I ended up there as one of their instructors, as an academic staff member, with the blessing of the dean. Now, why she asked me is because of, I think, Aaron Brower, who at that time was also in the ILS program. He was a professor in social work. He became the associate vice chancellor for teaching and learning. Might be the assistant vice chancellor, some kind of a vice chancellor for teaching and learning in Bascom. But he was the faculty director of Bradley, which was a res hall dormitory out that had students choosing to live there and then programming around it. And he had tapped me on the shoulder and said, Kathy, you'd be great. You know, flattery will get you another person to help with the Bradley Living Learning Community. So out I went and I taught some sections out there. I went to dinner with the kids, generally enjoyed it, and then I also knew Aaron because I was teaching the only ethnic studies course in the entire university system in a chemistry department. So how you teach a chemistry course that gets the E designation kind of put me on a lot of people's radar screen as, what on earth is she doing? But it was the kind of job I had, that if I had time to do extra things, I could. And so I did. Nobody asked me to teach it. I had no license to teach it. I just said I always wanted to teach it. And that's why that whole set of nuclear books is on the shelf next to you. I co-taught first with a Navajo colleague of uranium and American Indians. That qualified as E, because the uranium was on their reservation.
So you were teaching this class before you were invited to teach through Integrated Liberal Studies.
They went around sort of cherry-picking interesting-looking faculty and instructional academic staff members and said, we think you'd fit over here. We teach all sorts of interesting, integrated, interdisciplinary courses. Come join us.
So what courses have you taught through ILS then? Or is it taught through something else? And
no,
it's
actually ILS is a program in Letters and Science. It has its own UDDS number, has its own listing in the timetable. It gives a certificate. And I've taught the capstone. In fact, I'm teaching that right now because I still have a joint appointment in the College of Letters and Science in ILS. I've taught a course called The Radium Girls and the Firecracker Boys.
I'm going to need to know a bit more.
There are two books. One's called The Radium Girls, 1920s, the women who had watches and a very fine brush and put the radium paint on the numerals so they glowed in the dark. And all would have been well if they hadn't licked their brushes. But they ingested the radium And long story short, they died. Bone cancer of one variety or another. Radium is a calcium mimic. Ended up in their bones and killed them. I was one of the first public health radioisotope injuries in this country. So that's the story of the Radium Girls. And the Firecracker Boys were the men who worked in the Manhattan Project under Edward Teller. He was the father of the hydrogen bomb. And he, for a variety of reasons, got his wings clipped and could no longer do atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons the way they did in the 50s and the 60s, and maybe some places even into the 70s. So he started looking for peaceful uses of atomic bombs, and he got the bright idea, since they wouldn't let him string them across and blast open the Panama Canal, and they wouldn't let him mine with atomic weapons. The territory of Alaska needed a harbor. He was sure of it. So his plan was to take 6 hydrogen bombs up to the coast of Alaska, near Point Hope, points out to the Bering Strait, and blast a harbor in the shape of a polar bear. He got nicknamed the Firecracker Boys because this was the Alaskan territory, I guess. And one July, he and his merry boys landed on this coast and tried to set up tents to the amusement of the Alaskan natives who were living up there. I met some of them, and in fact, I even met some from Point Hope. And the story, they got nicknamed the Firecracker Boys because that's what they were going to do. The project never happened, but boy, it got very close. So with those two stories, the story of the Radium Girls and the story of the Firecracker Boys, I say, I'm going to tell you two stories. Your job in the course is go anywhere on the planet and find me a third one where your story has to have radioactivity, has to have people. The two have to be connected. And if you don't have people, you don't have a story. And if you don't have radioactivity, you don't have a story. Find me one and tell it. And they do. So that was one, I mean, it's a very ILS-y course, integrated all across time, across space, across science, across history, across culture. So I taught that one, and then the course I'm teaching right now, Food and Energy on the Campus, is another ILS course.
And that's Food and Energy on Campus is different from the Capstone course?
Yeah. So I've taught ILS 126, that's the Food and Energy. I've taught the Rain Girls and the Firecracker Boys. It has another title, but that's what I call it. ILS 251, and I've taught the Capstone ILS 400. So I've taught 3 courses in that program, I guess is the word, not department. It doesn't have a tenure.
What do the students have to create or submit in the Capstone class?
Oh. It's what they just did. They have 2 assignments. The first one is Alexander Micklejohn. He's a bit of history on this campus. You know of him?
I know of him.
Experimental College in the 20s. Founder of the ILS program, mm-hmm. in his own way. He's come back from the dead. And we have to decide where to put him on campus. Is he going to be the dean the way he was at Amherst? Is he going to be the vice provost for teaching and learning like Aaron Brower? Is he going to be a faculty member in ILS, or is he going to chair ILS? Well, since they don't know what any of those people really do, I send them off all over campus. Go interview the dean, go interview Aaron, go interview a chair, go interview some faculty members, and learn what they do, how they fit in, how they lead, what personality traits are helpful. Then study Alexander Micklejohn through his biography, which Adam Nelson wrote in School of Ed, and make a match, and then defend your case. So that's their first assignment. And their second assignment is Micklejohn style. You teach a class with a couple of your classmates on topic of anything that's integrated. So yesterday we had a class on coffee. They brought it in, they talked about it, they told stories of it, and they engaged the class for 2 hours on coffee. The week before it was on graffiti. Public art. So that's the Capstone. It's called Education, Leadership, and Character, and some want to tell them they're the characters. Mm-hmm. So it was Micklejohn. Does that help get at what, briefly, what a Capstone is in ILS?
Mm-hmm. Why was that? Was Micklejohn already the assignment before you took over the class, or did Micklejohn become the assignment when you took over the
I adapted it from an assignment that Kathy Sell had done in teaching the capstone before me. So the credit for the idea should go to her, although the more recent development and who we interviewed and how we did it was what I did. But it was an assignment. It was a structure for the course that already existed.
Okay.
And it's a lot of fun.
Sounds like it. What, no, okay, so I think I got...
That's what I did in ILS.
Right. Are you, and you still, obviously you're teaching the capstone, so this is something, you have classes for ILS classes each semester?
Yes, because I have a joint appointment right now in Nelson, which is my tenure home. Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and College of Letters and Science in the ILS program. And this really gets to the heart of what was going on. Chemistry wouldn't tenure me. For a variety of reasons, I don't think many of them had to do with me personally, but nonetheless it affected me personally. And the deans, thank you, the dean, moved my line out of chemistry into ILS. And then eventually, as I understand it, gave half of my line to the Nelson Institute, which is not in LNS. But they wanted to keep me on campus, I think. I quickly was tenured from the academic staff, which was my goal anyway, since I was performing like a faculty member, and I left chemistry.
Now that was just a couple years ago. That
that's
you left
just
chemistry,
a couple
right?
years. I'm one of the few academic staff who found another. It's not like I found another home. I got reclassified.
There's some things I want to ask about chemistry, but I want to sort of keep on this new tact that you're. Life is taken here on campus. So I want to talk more about your work for the Nelson Institute as well. So what classes do you teach through them?
I teach the capstone over here too.
Okay.
And the first capstone they asked me to teach was literally the Radium Girls and the Firecracker Boys over here. You know, very environmental in terms of nuclear landscapes. So I taught that one. I've taught two other capstones over here that really helped me prepare for the course that I now teach regularly. I teach one of the large intro environmental studies course, which on the books is called Principles of Environmental Science. Because I'm one of the scientists over here, and they said, teach anything you want. And so I'm teaching it jointly with ILS, but this is the one I call Energy and Food on Campus. It's a sort of an intro sustainability course based on how does energy get on our campus, who uses it, where does it go, how do we conserve it, and food, how does it get on our campus, and of course, how does the waste get off our campus. So I've been chasing hamburgers around from cow to compost heap, even though they don't compost. I've been looking at light bulbs, I've been in the steam tunnels, I've been in the heating and cooling plants, I've climbed through buildings and had a merry time.
Outside there's a poster about utensils.
The Secret Life of Light of Knives, Forks, and Spoons. By the way, it fell down and it's on the floor behind you. But my students investigated. Here we go. Let me get Exhibit A and B that you can't see on the tape. But I keep them handy.
Right, so Kay. You now have in your hand some utensils.
I have a plastic knife, fork, and spoon and a metal knife, fork, and spoon. When I went to college, when you went to college, did you use all metal utensils?
Yes.
Yeah. We even had tablecloths back in the 60s.
We didn't have tablecloths.
No. We had china, too. And at most of the unions in recent years, it's been plastic knives, forks, and spoons. Why didn't we make the switch, and does it make any sense to switch back? Well, thinking this was a small, bounded little question, I sent some undergraduates merrily investigating it, and we just got into layer after layer after layer of, should we switch back? And the answer is, if you do the math, yes, except for one thing.
with one thing.
Yeah, the interviewer has puzzled look on his face. The student steal it. So it walks away from the dining services to the dorm rooms, to the apartments, and it would be a clear win, you know, looking at the environmental costs, the social costs, the economic costs, all the costs of metal, if it stayed where it was put. So we opened trash bags, we found it in there, some of it gets thrown out, we went to dorms, we found it in there, we went to the thrift shop, St. Vincent de Paul, we found it there. So it's a perfect story of, you know, science, it doesn't give you the answers, it's human behavior. But that's an example of what we did in one of the capstones, The Secret Life of Knives, Forks, and Spoons. I'm still puzzling over this one.
So do you require some type of project in the intro class? You just mentioned the one about energy and food. Is that the student?
I love having students do projects.
Why is that?
Because they come back with such amazing creative things. In the Radium Girls and the Firecracker Boys, they were storytellers. They went all over the planet telling stories of, you know, uranium mines or nuclear weapons or radioisotopes in hospitals or caribou eating the fallout from Chernobyl, or they found stories. In the food and energy class, I say you can pick a superpower, and I give them three. The power of super sight, where you can see through walls, or the power of time travel, you can go forward or backward in history, or the power of being able to converse with the animals and the plants. Take your power, use it on campus to investigate something and come back and report. So the funniest one that I do is when the one who could listen to animals talking filmed a conversation between a cow and a chicken. And the cow was trying to convince the chicken that the chicken should be on the dinner plate. The chicken was trying to convince the cow that, no, you should eat the cow. Actually, no, they weren't trying to convince each other. They were trying to convince the audience why you should eat one or the other of them. And actually, the tagline is, you know, it makes a whole lot of sense to eat less meat anyway and eat more vegetable-based, plant-based. But that was listening in on a conversation between a cow and a chicken.
How large is that intro class?
100, 120, give or take.
And does it stay at that level? I ask because my assumption would be that students might see that this isn't just to sit here and absorb and take a test, so I don't want to be a part of it. Is that an incorrect assumption on my account?
It would be if it weren't a physical science class and the others, excuse me, are so much worse that they really would enjoy doing this one. You know, would you rather be in it's got a lab, you know, we're out opening trash bags, we made biodiesel out of French fry oil last year, we were doing all sorts of crazy things, or would you rather be titrating with a burette?
Since I don't know what that latter thing is, I will go with the former.
Would you rather be sitting in chemistry 103, 104, calculating problem after problem after problem after problem, or do you rather be crawling around in the steam tunnels trying to figure out what keeps our campus warm? So I hate to say it, but at times I think we look good by comparison. So I've never had any trouble getting students to enroll. In fact, I usually have to turn them away.
Do you have any possible new classes in the that you're interested in teaching or developing?
I'm still developing this energy and food one. There's no textbook. I have to run around campus learning things. What was I just doing? Oh, this morning. On the ground, you can see a whole bunch of colored beads and posters, and this is the lab activity where students get to journey from carbon reservoir to carbon reservoir and make a record of their journey with beads on a bracelet, and I've got to sort through the steps in the journey and make it work out. So that's what I was doing this morning. I was getting these things printed big enough that people could see them. So I have lots of loose ends that I'm still developing. That's how I keep my grad students busy.
So you just obviously just mentioned grad students. Do you have grad students assisting you in each of these classes?
Yes.
The ILS and the...
Yes.
So besides that, what other sorts of activities do you have to keep your grad students busy?
One of them's working on campus lighting. We swapped out, if you look above your head, there are fluorescent light bulbs in here. They used to be incandescent. In the early 2000s, the physical plant went on this bulb swapping campaign, taking out the low efficiency bulbs that were better at generating heat than light, and swapping in the ones that were better in generating light than heat. Probably cut our campus energy cost by 20%. And now they're swapping these out with LEDs, since they've been so much improved in the nature of the light and how quickly they go on and how long they take to burn out. But even this raises questions of the whole life cycle of the bulb. It's not just the bulb when it's in the cycle. What did it take to make it, and what happens to it after you are done with it? So there are enough questions in lighting that keep a lot of people, including me, busy for a long time. So that's an example of something we do, just like chasing around the knife, forks, and spoons.
Mm-hmm. Well, this might lead to one question I wanted to ask that's on your resume. It seems starting around the middle of last decade, 2005, 6, maybe 7, you started to either be a part of or sort of the lead on some large grants. Is that tied to issues that you found in having worked for your graduate students, or is there something sort of completely different?
It's more recent because as an academic staff member, it was really hard to write for grants in your own name. And until I could finally get the system to let me do what I wanted to do, and then easy when I became a faculty member, I just didn't bother writing grants because I got tired of trying to get all the signatures and people saying that you can write a grant. And I was saying, yeah, I know I can write a grant, but you have permission to write a grant. Oh.
So let me... You said it was more recent. Let me just maybe pop out a couple of these and see what comes up. I can quickly find them. So, like, the first... So how about... So almost $600,000 together for the planet... Community Environmental Scholars Program and S-STEM.
S-STEM. That's actually a student scholarship grant. Very little in it for the university, a whole lot in it for students. And when I came over to the Nelson Institute, somebody mentioned, you know, we ought to have an S-STEM grant, that's what it's called. And it's money I pulled in to fund students who are in the Community Environmental Scholars Program, and if it's need-based, they get up to $8,000 a year, and the money is funded through some type of visa. There's a, I want to say an H-N-1 visa or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
All the money that's collected in that is given to the National Science Foundation to give to U.S. students, so that when people come in and pay visa fees to work, we reinvest the money in our own students.
Mm-hmm.
They won't just give it to you, though. You have to have a program that supports, mentors, helps move these students from their degree into either grad school or the job market.
So this is for undergrad?
Yeah, it's for undergrad.
Oh. It looks like you just recently... 2012, maybe?
Yeah, it's in its second year. Somebody who has just walked in the office was writing it. Well, Adrian is a co-teacher of the S-STEM students with me. And earlier this week, our external evaluator was in, and we're probably going to put in another one and just double the number of students because we have the infrastructure here to take care of them. But strangely enough, nobody at UW-Madison had ever written one of these things for undergraduate. That's my love. You know, going all the way back to interview number one, I came to college because I wanted to teach. So I wrote grants that tried to make things better for students.
So this STEM money, your part in it is to not teach them in the classroom, but help them navigate?
We teach them I forgot, you asked me what courses I teach. It's Environmental Studies 402. It's a one credit seminar that all the scholarship recipients enroll in. And there's about 25 of them in a given year. And they take the course three times. I don't know how much detail to provide here, but they're awarded the scholarship going into their junior year, and it's good for junior fall spring and senior year fall spring, so it's four semesters. It's good for three of the fall semesters. They need to be in a seminar with me and Adrian, who walked in, and I think Rob, who you met. Oh, Molly, she was here. She and Bob teaching them too, and they it's a one-room schoolhouse in that it has all the years in together, but each time they take it, they play a different role. They're all environmental studies or science kids of one way or another, and they're interested in, I think the tagline is linking your passion for the environment with community.
So what do you mean by each time they're in a different role?
The first time they enroll, they're tasked with exploring the Nelson Institute. They spend a whole month. Their assignment every week is the same. Go out and spend 2 hours talking to people, going to seminars, crawling around the building, looking on the website, doing anything you want. The next month in the course, they're tasked with bring whatever you found back and teach your classmates. You're getting a theme here. Mm-hmm. So one of them made a Jeopardy game, and the whole class, they played Jeopardy on the Nelson Institute with categories of questions. One group did a scavenger hunt and sent them all out to find things. Another group brought in a guest speaker, and the kids all interacted and interviewed the speaker. I said, the only rule is you can't let anybody talk for an hour. That's not interactive. You can't just have somebody deliver a speech. So the first time they enroll, their job is to spend a month being detectives of the Nelson Institute, and the second month they teach it. Meanwhile, the second time they're in there, the minute they get in there, they go out in the community and work on a project for a while. And then they come back in and teach what they did in the community toward the end of the semester. And the third year, so you can see each time they get a different role.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Something I wanted to ask, but it's gone. I'm sure it'll come back. So I do want to go back, possibly briefly, to the early 2000s when it looks like you were on quite a few committees within the chemistry department. But I don't see that in your resume up until then.
That's because academic staff were allowed on the committees. But once they allowed them, I was their poster child.
So you think you were asked to be on the committee because you were the academic staff, kind of hate to use this word, but token?
Token, yes, or the one who had been there. For example, there had always been a faculty awards committee. There had never been an academic staff awards committee, but the faculty awards committee was always nominating each other for different things and noticing who hadn't gotten awards, and I gently but firmly pointed out to them that there should be a similar thing for the academic staff. And I also, since I had won all of them already, I had no oar in the water need to win anymore, so I spent any number of years trying to teach people how to craft a nomination, how to get promoted, because it wasn't a culture of promoting people through the ranks, if there were any, for the academic staff, and there were some. How to get a distinguished prefix, get an indefinite appointment. And since I had all these things and had negotiated the system, who else was going to do it? So just yesterday, I went over to watch somebody else get an award, last Friday, and somebody stopped me there who I hardly knew and thanked me. saying, it's because of you that I went and did this, and now he's chairing that committee. But he said, so I said to him, so when are you going to get a distinguished prefix? He said, well, I said, send me your stuff. So he sent me two or three things back and forth, and I said, go for it. You're ready. I sat on the committee for 6 or 9 years. Go for it. But it just took a nudge to somebody else to say, you'd be really, you're good at this. You've got a great record. So it goes on. But that's why it all happened then, partly because I volunteered.
Mm-hmm. And either the first or the second session, we talked about academic staff getting on committees, and then, I don't know if takeover was the right word, but sort of led them because they showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case in these chemistry?
It didn't happen in chemistry because the committees that I was largely on were ones that related to academic staff issues. So the funny thing was, at least in the awards committee, they stacked it with three academic staff members and three faculty, and they had one of the faculty members chairing. Well, the faculty stopped coming because they weren't particularly interested in academic staff awards, and they didn't know anything about them. And eventually we sort of took that committee over, and I don't think anybody minded.
So it did sort of happen, but the committees were on academic staff issues anyway.
Anyway.
One more somewhat random thing. It's one of the things I'm interested in, having served on a couple myself. I see you served on a couple of search and screen committees. One for the AD of Student Academic Affairs, and then the other for Director of Sustainability Research and Education. Why serve on those committees, and what do you think you got out of them or added to them?
Let's talk about what I got out of them, and then I'll see if what I possibly could have added to them, except a little happy chaos. I continued to learn things that I hadn't a clue about by being on search and screen committees. So I was on the one that hired, for example, John Wiley as provost. He was dean of the grad school. That was the search committee I learned you can win the interview but lose the appointment. So I watched that happen. There was somebody else who applied who interviewed far better than he. I also learned how people can manipulate a search committee without their knowing. I mean, I just didn't know a lot of things. For example, we interviewed this young lovely who never should have been interviewed. She was too young. She was nowhere near ready, but they're saying, oh, we need to have a woman. And so, and this wasn't doing anybody a favor. And, you know, I even said so. I said, it doesn't look like she's qualified. Just by her age. Oh, you can't discriminate by age. And I said, yeah, you can't, but this isn't a fair fight. So there were things that involved, because she held one of the slots, some of the people who actually might have been giving John Wiley some competition never got interviewed. But it was thing after thing like that that I started seeing. There's a whole lot more going on in search committees that get set at the table. And then later, when I was on the search committee just a few years ago for Letters and Science, Associate Dean of Student Academic Affairs, the person who won the interview again didn't get the job. But in this case, I actually understood it better, because the person who had sort of been the interim and demonstrated track record doing it, he didn't interview as nearly as well as she did. But he did get the job, and I understood why the dean did it. So when I was in two different cases, one where I was really pissed at the person who gave the best interview, and I partly learned that interviewing isn't the only thing that counts in a search. And the skill of interviewing doesn't necessarily translate to the skill of doing the job. But I also saw it from both. So the more I was on search committees, the more I started seeing different sides of the search, including honoring the people who may have been interim in the job. So I, but in all kinds of ways in search committees. Oh, I also learned things not to do when you interview. For example, I watched somebody interview in the sustainability position who rightly was pissed at her unit. But she badmouthed her unit during the interview. And one of the things I learned from that is, it doesn't matter how bad where you were or what it is, you leave that out of the interview. So I thought this was worth learning. So I'm always learning. I never know what I'm going to learn, but search and screen committees, I learned a whole lot more than I ever expected to.
I have a follow-up to that. I don't know exactly how to phrase it. It seems to me sort of a pattern of your time here is getting involved in things and then, in your words, or somewhat in your words, learning more than you thought you were going to. And I'm wondering if part of the reason why you have students do projects is that as well. And I'm just, it may be more of an opinion or a comment. It just seems to me that you're requiring these students to learn about campus, whether or not they're going to be on a campus ever again. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Some people might say about me, but maybe in general, that you know you need to be strategic and you need to choose only the opportunities that are going to take you on the path where you're going. And that's fine, except if you don't know quite where you're going, you never know quite what you're going to need. And you, there must, I think there are some games where you find things along the way and you pick them up and you're not quite sure what they are, but they're treasures or they're objects or they're something. And I can identify with that. I've just picked up treasures and pearls as well as some things I haven't needed along the way and found what they were good for later on. I'd love to run that one by my husband and say, did I find you and then discover later on what you were good for, but we're not going to go there.
I could have him listen to this.
Yeah, that would, that's all, that's just an opportunity I couldn't miss. If he were in the room, I would say, like husbands, pick one up and find out later what they're good for. Just kidding.
I guess a question about retirement. For me, it's a really tiny light at the end of a long tunnel. I'm wondering, is it something you even think about at this point? If you do, what are your thoughts about it?
I have what I think is a gem of a piece of knowledge for somebody who's listening some point. When I got to age 58 and got vested and then got within hailing distance of retirement, it was the most freeing thing in the world to say, I can walk. So if I don't choose and find things that I want here, because in a lot of ways I stayed out of responsibilities that you need to have a salary, a job. You can't just go running in every direction because you don't like things. There's always been things I haven't liked, but there's been enough with them I like. But these days I say, I can leave any time. So if I'm not having a good time, I'm out of here. And that is just the most wonderful thought in the world that I'm here because I'm choosing it as opposed to because I have to do it. And it also leaves me freer to maybe I dare say mouth off now and then, or say no, or say yes enthusiastically. I find it a great freedom that I could retire, but I haven't. You know, I'm still only 63, but I can retire. I can leave. I hope you get to enjoy at some point saying, I can leave. Of course, I was free to leave any time.
Yeah. I mean, we're all free to leave. But sometimes there's issues that make it more difficult to make that decision then.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A couple of questions about legacy. So, what do you think some of your biggest accomplishments are on this campus?
I keep thinking that I might have had them, but they're, what's the word? Is it ephemeral? Ephemeral?
Ephemeral.
Ephemeral. I'm kind of glad I've seen things that I've worked really hard on come to an end. And it has, for example, I've worked for years on this Chemistry in Context project. I've been editor-in-chief, and I'm in the process of rotating off. And honestly, the way I see the project starting to go, I go, ah, what are they doing to it? And, you know, someone will yell and scream and say, you can't do this, you're wrecking it. And in another, I realize, you know, things are going to change. Now, maybe they're wrecking it, maybe they're not. There's a number of us who think they're wrecking it. But, you know, it actually isn't going to go on the way it was. It isn't going to stay the same. The ILS program is in turmoil right now. It had been, what is it, has a glorious future behind it. Is that the line?
If it is, it's a great line.
And it came out of some movie, Back to the Future or whatever. But I've already seen some of the things that I have really invested in crumble. So in some ways, that's helped me get over the legacy thing sooner rather than later, thinking that I have a different kind of legacy. I got a message from a student over the weekend who had taught in 2002. What she wrote back to me probably brought a bigger smile than any project or initiative or program or whatever. If there's any legacy, it would be with students, and I would tell them, pass it on.
Do you mind talking a little bit more? I know it's in your, I think your web bio, the chemistry and context.
Mm-hmm.
You mind talking a little bit more about, you know, who, we don't know who's going to listen to this. Chemistry and context, which is thrown, you mentioned it.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could elaborate on it.
It's a project of the American Chemical Society that started in the 80s. As I understand it, the American Chemical Society, which is, I believe, the world's largest scientific professional society, upwards of 150,000 members, realized that a lot of people were taking chemistry and learning to hate it for life. This wasn't necessarily a good idea, and we ought to have a project that could teach at least the non-majors chemistry, as if people and the planet and chemistry in their lives mattered. And designed a textbook to do that. I came in on the third edition and worked my way right up to being editor-in-chief, which I've done for the last 6 or 7 years. And it's the book I taught out of, but instead of teaching how to balance a chemical equation and solve a buffer problem and calculate a rate constant and find delta G, we look at the air you breathe and what's in it and how it got there and what difference it might make and how nuclear fission, back to nuclear, works in a reactor, but radioactivity can both cause cancer and cure cancer. And boy, these are some amazing conversations that you might need to know a little chemistry to have a voice in the conversation. So the project teaches real world topics and then the chemistry you need to know to understand the topic. So you don't necessarily know what chemistry you're going to get, but whatever the topic is, there's a whole bunch of chemistry connected to it. The ozone hole, chlorofluorocarbons, climate change, combustion, air quality, combustion again. So that's the project. And I see it now turning in another direction that I'm really not interested in. And it's a project I thought would go on, and I would hand the mantle to somebody else, just as it was handed to me, that it was over, you know, 20 years that we kept the theme that you teach the chemistry you need to know, and you actually you don't need to know the other stuff if you're never going to take another course in your life. And it seems to me like the project is going more toward there's some chemistry you have to know, and we're always going to teach this, 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 and this, and this, because you can't leave a chemistry course without covering this stuff. And I'm going, actually you can. But we disagree, and it's going to go in a direction where the context in the real world and the issues that don't have easy answers are probably going to fall by the wayside. So I'm sorry to see it go, but I can't stop it. Mm-hmm. That sure was a good lesson in what I thought I had carefully shepherded and brought to a national audience of, you know, it sells 25,000 units. This is a big project. I thought this would go on, but I don't think it is. I'm sorry, I feel the loss, but it isn't, you know, you asked what's your legacy. Well, I thought it might be this, but clearly it's not going to be. Things come and go. And maybe it's better to know that now than rather than trying to preserve it.
What about things you either tried to do or wish you could have done and didn't happen? Do you have some regrets about your time here?
Oh, I think the biggest regret, going off in a totally different direction, is I wish I'd had more kids.
Well, I'm sure either you have thought of this or people have talked to you about this. I mean, in a sense, the letters you get, the people that you mentor, it might be, it's not biological, it's not genetic, but...
I treat them like my kids.
Yeah, there should be, I think if you do this well, there should be a little bit of that.
Yeah.
There should be being proud of them when they succeed.
That's kind of what I told the kids in my lecture hall the year that our son died. I said, you're all my kids now. Not that you weren't before.
Right.
And while it's true, at another level it's not true. You know, they don't get to come home
right.
And I don't get to play with them.
Right. No, it's exactly true. I mean, you can... I've never gone through what you've gone through. But I mean, you can say that, and you can have sort of surrogate children.
Mm-hmm.
Your students can be surrogate children, but they're still surrogates. It's still,
yeah.
It's not the same.
I think that's,
I should say, I would assume it's not the same.
Yeah, it's not the same, although I don't think I would have seen as clearly how they really all do belong to me and each other in a way if I had been focusing on my own. So there's some wisdom in that. You know, you always gain something when you lose something, but it's not that you want to lose something that to gain the other thing.
Right. Kathy, I have no other questions. So do you have any other thing you'd like to, any other thoughts or anecdotes you'd like to get on the record before we conclude?
Well, you've asked me that 3 times. Getting old is an amazing process. Nothing prepares you for it. Although the analogy may not work exactly for you, nothing prepared me for childbirth. It was the 5 minutes like, push? I mean, what do you mean push? I've never pushed it. What are you talking about? And they say, you know how to push. Just push. And you know, your body figures it out. Getting old is kind of like that. You never have done it before. And getting old in an academic job is that too, because people will start realizing you're not going to be here forever. And that comes with pluses and minuses. Oh, we don't have to deal with her anymore. Or, oh, we better do this while she's still here.
Right.
So I don't know how to capture that aspect of the whole thing. I mean, the fact that I've even done 2 oral histories means I'm old enough to have a history. So maybe your being here just says I've got a history. I didn't know.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for the time you've given me these 3 sessions. I appreciate it. So this concludes the oral history with Kathy Middlecamp.